the main finding from the study was really that there is a characteristic microbes that you see enriched in the stool samples of cancer patients across the global populations. And those were, I mean, Fusobacterium was among them, but there were also a couple others, Parvimonas or Peptostreptococcus, that are usually very low abundant in the healthy microbiome, if not absent. They had been described also by others as oral pathogens initially. So this was really a signature that we could tease out with both statistics and machine learning quite clearly. And it would also validate in independent populations that we only got access to in the revision.
Welcome to the Science, Microbes and Health podcast from ISAP. We're a nonprofit scientific organization advancing science in probiotics, prebiotics, and related fields. This episode is part of our series exploring gut microbiota and colorectal cancer. We'll be speaking with experts about how microbes in the human gut contribute to colorectal cancer development and how this research is driving advances in diagnosis and treatment.
Hi, everybody, and welcome to the Science, Microbes, and Health podcast. My name is Colin Hill.
And I'm Dan Tancredi.
And our guest today, we're delighted to have Georg Zeller from the University of Leiden Medical Center. And Georg is going to talk to us today about the links between the microbiome and colon cancer. But when I saw your bio first, Georg, I saw, you know, you're a bioinformatician. And if I see someone as a biologist, I would immediately ask, yes, but what area of biology? When I see a bioinformatician, I just think, oh, yeah, that's a perfect description. But obviously, you're a type of bioinformatician. Can you tell us something about the type of bioinformatician you are?
That's a very good question. I guess I started out as almost like a computer scientist with an interest in biology and essentially a double minor in biology as an undergraduate. And I worked for my PhD, I worked on machine learning applications in genomics, but I felt a need to move deeper into the biology for my postdoc. And I really wanted to work on complex, on interesting biological problems. And at the time, the microbiome posed the perfect challenge for someone who really wanted to deal with complex data where there aren't any easy answers. And so I think we still try to keep a level of computational sophistication and data analysis sophistication in my research group now, but we are definitely driven by biological questions and answering questions that are of biomedical relevance, hopefully, ultimately.
And I know you spent a long time at Per Borg's lab in Embla, and of course we deeply mourn the loss of Per, an amazing figure in our field and an absolute giant in our field. Yeah. What was exactly the approach that you were taking when you were in Per's lab of, and what got you into colon cancer as the subject of your analysis?
Yeah, when I joined Per's group as a postdoc, I worked on multiple projects, and I came from a relatively formal training and background, and I was always looking for problems where I could maybe apply this. And this wasn't so easy because Per was really at the forefront of biology, and I needed to learn a lot initially. And Per was a great mentor. He really taught me a lot. And eventually I ended up working together with other people from the group on his ERC advanced grant at that time that was on the microbiome and colorectal cancer. So he already at that time saw that was an interesting area to explore. And this was something where we had the right statistical background and machine learning tools to ask questions of, how well would microbiome readouts discriminate cancer patients from controls if you just have a fecal readout of the microbiome. So that's how I essentially got into this. And of course, there were a lot of other things going on in terms of method development. It was really a very inspiring group with a lot of really influential personalities on my career that are now professors all over Europe and still cherished colleagues and friends.
We can see in the very important work you did, in the middle part of your career, and then most recently with your meta-analysis, the things that are kind of common, but also the things that have changed in what you're discovering. Can you talk to us about the recent findings?
Yeah.
About being able to use the stool to kind of make an educated guess about colorectal cancer risk?
Yeah, so I mean, this all started off with this probably my most impactful paper from the postdoc time in Per's lab, where we had this first cohort of colorectal cancer patients and then, tumor-free individuals as controls and also sampled, clinicians in France, Iraj Soubani specifically, had also sampled intermediate steps of adenomas and early stage tumors. And in this first study, it was mostly around the question of, you know, how distinct is the microbiome of a cancer patient from a control? Can that be teased out by statistics or classification methodology? But that was a single study with a French study population of, I don't know, 150 people and a little bit of validation on German individuals. We also looked a little bit into Crohn's disease and ulcerative colitis patients, but large and by was just a single study. And there seemed to be an interesting signature that before that, there had also been some publications from Matthew Myerson's group, but also Rob Holtz on the tumor microbiome. So not the stool samples, but really the tissue samples. And you know, all these studies showed Fusobacterium enrichment in common. So that showed us even with a fecal readout, we are on the right track. And from that onwards, we, you know, many other people have collected data and looked at this question, how is the microbiome different in cancer patients? And so that really created opportunities for conducting meta-analysis, which we did already a couple of years back. Then PEAR was still a driving force in this. We published a meta-analysis in Nature Medicine on 5 or then 8 studies on colorectal cancer using exclusively shotgun metagenomics. And that was a back-to-back effort also with Nicola Segata's group and a few others, Takuchi Yamada in Japan.
So let's talk about that. That analysis was very impressive because a lot of people think there's so much geographical and technical variability from one study to the other. How could you possibly overcome that? And I believe you were a senior author on that paper, and you guys developed like a really effective workflow for that. Can you give us just the, you know, the insights that you can overcome that kind of heterogeneity?
Yeah, I mean, that was also the question that we set out to answer, right? I mean, we were aware. I mean, there were also in PEAR group, there was this international standardization consortium going on, and we had also contributed a little bit to that. And we were aware of the batch effects that you create by different DNA extraction methods and all of that. But a crucial question in that phase was really, do we have comparable data in light of all this technical heterogeneity? And I mean, of course, there is also biological heterogeneity if you look globally, right? But the main finding from the study was really that there is a characteristic microbes that you see enriched in the stool samples of cancer patients across the global populations. And those were, I mean, Fusobacterium was among them, but there were also a couple others, Parvimonas or Peptostreptococcus, that are usually very low abundant in the healthy microbiome, if not absent. They had been described also by others as oral pathogens initially. So this was really a signature that we could tease out with both statistics and machine learning quite clearly. And it would also validate in independent populations that we only got access to in the revision. And of course, since all of that was based on shotgun metagenomics data, we were also exploring a little bit more the functionalities that you can read out of your shotgun metagenomes. And at the time, the thing that we were most excited about was bile acid metabolism. So you could really see this operon for 7-alpha deoxygenation. Bile acids, this was clearly enriched in the cancer metagenomes. And yeah, we also saw colibactin and fusobacteria, the virulence factors. So that was kind of, yeah, making a round story on the shotgun metagenomic side. Yeah.
Yeah. And Georg, can I ask, do you see the microbiome essentially taxonomically, like a microbiologist would see it, with different bugs with their Latin names, and they're all very distinct from one another? Or do you see it more as a kind of soup of genes that are carried in these different organisms, but it's more that the microbiome functions more at the gene level or the taxa level? I know that's a very hand-wavy kind of question, but...
Oh, but it's a very good question anyway, yeah. And I mean, you know, it's like Schrodinger's cat. Probably it's both, right? I mean, sometimes I think a taxonomic readout is, I mean, in the end, the genes don't just circulate in a soup because they're organized in genomes or plasmids maybe or mobile elements, but still in the end, they are all carried by organisms as functional units, right? So I think taxa are a very good proxy for many things. And what we have seen time and again is that when we have these classifiers that give you an AUC of how well you can distinguish one group of people from another, that typically they work better if you have a taxonomic profile as an input than a functional profile. I think I don't remember a single case where we did get better classification results with a functional profile as input. But the functional stuff is, of course, very interesting because that leads us to hypotheses, to understand biology, to gain insights on processes. And I mean, that's been, I think it's just enormous to see that you can actually trace colibactin genes in these genomes, or yeah, the secondary bile acid production operons, or these kind of things. So that really confirms that in the metagenome at diagnosis, these factors are enriched. And that's, I think that's enormous body of great work in animal models, but also in vitro models, that really tries to tease apart the mechanisms that might underlie carcinogenesis caused by these microbes. And I think it's important to link between our omics data-driven bioinformatics efforts to these mechanistic studies and really say, okay, look, the mechanism that you resolve here that we actually do see in patients. And maybe sometimes in other cases, it's not so easy to see them. So that can also maybe prioritize mechanistic studies, I think.
Thinking as a very simple microbiologist, you know, my sense of all microbes in an environment do things that favor their own survival, growth, and persistence. So what's the advantage for a bacterium to cause colorectal cancer in somebody's gut? I mean, they're living in there, they've 37 degrees, they're being fed, everything's absolutely perfect for them. I know that's an exaggeration. And yet they produce compounds or they do things which trigger, you know, a very disruptive event, which of course they can't know in advance is going to favor their continued survival. What do you think is the evolutionary reasoning behind that kind of behavior?
Yeah, I think these microbes are just adapted to live in host tissues, probably. Maybe not intracellularly, all of them inside host cells. But I mean, you know, coming from biofilms or from inflamed lesions in the oral cavity, I think they're probably adapted to a lifestyle where they live off components that host cells shed or that, you know, an inflamed environment produces. So many of them are, for example, proteolytic. I would imagine they live simply off, you know, cancer cell metabolic outputs in some form or the other. And I think it's also, I mean, I guess there's quite a bit of competition in the human gut microbiome. And there is nutrients, plenty of nutrients generally, but I think still there is competitions in niches. And I think this is maybe a unique niche that some of these cancer-associated bacteria have evolved.
I absolutely buy into the cancer-associated microbiota when the cancer is already formed and it's a new environment and they benefit from that new environment. But a bacterium with a generation time measured in minutes or hours initiating a cancer that might take years to develop, what's the evolutionary advantage there?
I think the bacteria are probably not, they're not working towards the human to develop a cancer or die of a cancer, I guess. But I think there is many mechanisms that are maybe relevant in cancer development. And I think, you know, these early genetic events by which cells might, you know, be reprogrammed towards a trajectory that could ultimately lead to cancer, maybe they aren't that rare. But then it's a question of whether these cells are detected by the immune system and cancer immune surveillance and then cleared, or whether there is a fusobacterium bacterium that, of course, has a selfish interest in such a cell or around such a host cell not to be cleared off by the immune system. So it may trigger immune evasion mechanisms, which are, for fusobacterium, for example, described in the literature. So maybe it's just a co-evolving process, right? I mean, if there are selfish cancer genes or cells and selfish microbes, maybe they form an alliance to escape immune surveillance.
Yeah, speaking of lifestyle, you in regard to Colin's question, you've shown that the markers of higher cancer risk are associated with like the meat-rich diets, and the more plant-based diets are, of course, are healthier. You've also shown modulation is possible, you know, having a healthier diet. Yeah. I'd be interested in hearing your thoughts, because I know you focused on the rise in early onset cancer, you know, colorectal cancer that's caused all of us alarm and has changed the minimum recommended age for screening from 50 down to 45. But you've actually found there's a lot of overlap in that early onset and late onset in terms of the signatures that characterize both. Can you talk a little bit about that? Were you surprised by that or not?
Yeah, so the project was actually motivated in part by really addressing this question of whether there's a distinct signature for early onset, which could, of course, be the case, right? I mean, given that the early onset rises are fairly recent, so it was a question that was relevant. And there were some some conflicting reports in the literature. So we said, well, if you have this large data set, let's investigate it. And what we found is that the signature is, I think, is virtually the same in terms of the microbiome that we detect in fecal samples at diagnosis. I should really say that precisely. Yeah. At the same time, of course, there is a lot of work on colibactin and looking at mutational signatures in cancer genomes that suggests that historical exposure to colibactin might be very different between early onset and late onset cases. And I think those two views are not mutually exclusive. It's just a question of maybe what's the more important driver for these cases in the end. But yeah, I think if you look at the time of diagnosis into the gut, but also in the tissue microbiomes, I think it's very difficult to see a difference in their microbiome.
How do you see this being translated into clinical practice, the different findings that you've had?
Yeah, so I think one of the questions, of course, that we have had in mind since the really early work with Per Borg is, can you develop diagnostic tests from the microbiome? And, you know, we have worked with a lot of classifiers, a lot of data, you know, tons of raw curves over the years. I think we came to the realization, and that's very much in line with Nicola Segata's work also, that the AUCs are not going above 0.85, 0.9. Yeah, that's, you don't see that, yeah, at the moment. And that's perhaps a little bit too low for being really sort of practically, I mean, at the level where you could really develop a diagnostic test that would be competitive with a FIT test. I mean, what's still an open question to me is, how well can we combine the existing fecal blood test, the FIT, with a microbiome readout? So I think we don't have a lot of data for that, unfortunately. So there's only very few data sets that all have a bit of their own issues. So it's not so easy to address this question at the moment.
Yeah.
Another open question is, what about early precancerous lesions, so the adenomas? I think there's also convincing literature out there. We surveyed that for our most recent paper in Cell Host and Microbe that suggests that adenoma detection from a fecal readout is not possible at the same accuracy as for colorectal cancer. And it doesn't matter if you take a colorectal cancer classifier that was trained on 7,000 samples and apply that to adenomas, or whether you train a specific classifier. They don't really reach accuracies above 0.7 AUC.
Yeah. I mean, these are pretty impressive AUCs, but I think you're right. They're not quite at the level that are needed for diagnosis. And really, the best cancer screening test is the one that the patient is willing to complete. And so it's not necessarily going to be easier to get diagnosed from this. But what I think your research has a big promise for future clinical uses in identifying interventions and mechanisms first and interventions targeting those.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a very relevant question. I mean, the microbiome can be modulated, unlike our genome or transcriptome. Yes. It's amenable to all kinds of modulations. And of course, it's a really exciting area. So I also, personally, I'm perhaps even more excited about the prospects for prevention. I mean, that's something we did explore a little bit in the Cell Host Microbe paper that we published a couple of weeks ago. So when you have such a cancer classifier, we can also apply this to all kinds of populations. Whether they have cancer or not is a secondary consideration. But we can ask, do normal people have a cancer-like microbiome? That's basically a bit like this, yeah. And occasionally you do see an individual that has a very high CRC score. And so, but with this universally applicable model, what we can do is we can really screen also all these dietary intervention studies, reanalyze the data. We can also look at larger cohorts for which habitual diet has been recorded. And that kind of opened a window to ask how the CRC microbiome signature, the cancer signature, is related to diet. And I mean, you could say maybe unsurprisingly, we found a negative correlation to fiber intake, but at least that's very well consistent with the epidemiological data that we already knew that, you know, fiber consumption is associated with a decreased risk of developing cancer. But you can now look which microbes are really responding also to these interventions. And it seems, I think we have some data that suggests that it's perhaps more the protective bacteria that you see disappearing in the cancer patients that more strongly respond to these diets. So I think that opens up some interesting questions for, you know, might there be antagonism, real antagonism between these bacteria and could we maybe also, you know, leverage that for modulatory or for preventive approaches? Can we, yeah, can we specifically feed those bacteria that would suppress cancer-associated or perhaps cancer-causing microbes?
Do you think that your data, I imagine it would have implications for the growing field of fecal microbiota transplants? I mean, somebody might present as a fully healthy individual, but yet they may have a microbiota that's predisposing them to cancer. And if they're used as a healthy, in inverted commas, donor, you know, will we see examples where maybe an acute problem was relieved by the FMT, but leads later in life or soon after that to development of CRC or something or other chronic diseases?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. I think what we should do, we should probably screen our donors also and really see whether, I mean, you know, we're talking about a handful of markers that I would be really worried about. We should probably make sure that those are not there in the donor microbiomes at high abundance. I mean, it depends also which indication areas for FMT we're talking about. You know, if this is a life-saving therapy for a patient with recurring, you know, C. diff infections,
yeah,
maybe it's a secondary consideration whether you might transplant microbes that could give them cancer 20 years down the line. But still, if you can avoid it, we should probably avoid that. Yeah, it's a risk.
Can you talk about extensions to other cancer types, like where you see a lot of promise and also how you can learn new things with using different cancer types with the same kind of approaches or similar approaches?
Yeah, I think that's a very interesting question that we also have started to work on. I mean, a couple of years back in collaboration with Pierre Borg and also Nuria Malatz from Spain, we had looked at pancreatic cancer and fecal profiles of pancreatic cancer patients. And even, I mean, pancreatic cancer is something that is really hard to diagnose early. So there is no early screening program. And usually when it's diagnosed, yeah, survival prospects are very low as a patient. So there's really an urgent need to develop non-invasive diagnostics. And what was quite encouraging about that work, the study that we published, I don't know, 3-4 years ago, is that there is a fairly strong microbiome signature also in these pancreatic cancer patients that for which you get similar AUCs as for colorectal cancer.
Yes.
And perhaps there's also the potential to combine that with clinical markers, blood markers or fecal markers. And so that's an idea I would love to explore in larger data sets, in larger cohorts. I think that might really lead to relevant.
Yeah, a 0.8 or a 0.85 could be really helpful, I would think, yeah, a situation like that.
I mean, that's a constant discussion I'm having with clinicians. Is that good enough? You know, it's a raw curve. And if you think about a very low incidence of this cancer, you know, certainly below 1% in the general population or in the population at risk, is that good enough? Is your precision good enough for really screening? But I think we don't know at this point, but it's certainly a question we should be following up on. And there is European calls now, EU calls for going in exactly that direction. So I think, yeah, the European Union has recognized the problem.
Are you at a point yet where you would recommend or at least theorize that somebody with CRC who's receiving treatment, whether surgical or chemotherapy, should be getting fecal transplants from individuals with, you know, without these markers that you do you think, or do you think we're not there yet?
Yeah, I think so of course the most exciting area in the field of cancer therapy is of course immunotherapy. So there is some early indication, and that's not work that we are involved in, but I find super exciting from people in Rome, I mean, or in Canada or Paris, where they looked at how the microbiome influences immunotherapy response. And of course, there is some strong indication that FMT may give patients a second chance that do not initially respond to immunotherapy. Or, I mean, nowadays studies published that even recommend or trial this as a first line approach to really give them FMT before they receive immunotherapy, and that seems to improve response rate. So that's, I mean, if I were a cancer patient to go on immunotherapy, I would, I mean, seriously consider FMT as a co-treatment option.
And do you think the direction of travel will be away from FMT and towards more defined consortia of bacteria where, you know, everything is sequenced, all the, not all of the risk factors, but some of the risk factors would be eliminated, and that might be the direction of travel? Or do you think that the communities, you know, the fecal communities themselves are important, that you can't really separate them out and grow them as synthetic communities?
I absolutely do see the conceptual appeal of defined communities, right? I mean, that would give us a much more defined intervention. It would de-risk the whole procedure. It would open the door for better commercialization, all these kind of things. The problem that I see is that we understand too little about what determines efficacy in FMT. If we had understood that better, we could really start rationally engineering these communities. At the moment, it's a lot of trial and error. And I mean, even in areas where, like, recurring C. diff infections, where FMT is extremely efficacious, the synthetic communities, yeah, haven't quite met their initial promise, I feel. So I think we, as a research community, we need to acknowledge that we're still in the beginning and we don't understand really what determines efficacy. Also in the context of immunotherapy, or, I mean, it might be different factors that really determine efficacy in different application areas. So I think we need to more thoroughly explore that and then come to conclusions about how to design, you know, more defined interventions that build on these principles.
Jörg, I hate to bring this to a close because it's such a fascinating conversation, but we're running out of time. So let me please just thank you again for joining us. Fascinating work, and we wish you every success with it because I think it's so important. And thanks again for joining us.
Yeah, thanks a lot for this opportunity. It was really a very stimulating conversation. Thanks a lot.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Science, Microbes and Health podcast from ISAP. If you've been enjoying the show, please follow and rate our podcast to help support our continued work. You can also send us your feedback, questions or topic suggestions by emailing info@isapscience.org and check the show notes for links and further information on this topic.